of streamers. She throws them across the table and wraps them around the chairs and ties bows around the forks. She sets a place for her mum next to the mannequin.
Just in case.
She pulls up a chair for herself between the mannequin and Rambo, pats down her dress and adjusts her hat. She feels the mannequin's eyes on her.
What?
She says.
She's just caught up.
She clears her throat.
Dear God,
she says, her hands in prayer, squinting at the mannequin through half-closed eyes.
Tonight we will be serving Fanta soup for entree, snakes and dinosaurs for main, a side salad of mint leaves, and banana sundae for dessert. I hope this is okay with you.
She fills her glass with grape juice.
But first, some toast.
She stands and clinks glasses with all her guests. She does it again. Because there's music to it. She does it faster and faster and skates around the table.
Clink, 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 clink.
And then skates around the other way.
Clink, 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 clink.
She sits on top of the table instead of in her chair. Because she's the boss. And they all eat and talk about how the dog from next door keeps making big poops on the lawn and how Mrs. Pucker always gets fancy makeup in the mail, but it doesn't help her. And how Ablett must be very sorry that he switched clubs because his new team plays like a bunch of girls. And the whole time, the mannequin watches her, without blinking, without saying a thing. Another fact about the world Millie knows for sure. She doesn't know where her dad's body is. When they visited her dad in the cemetery, he was in a tiny box in the wall.
Dad's too big for that,
she said.
It's a magic box, Millie's mum replied.
What kind of magic?
Just magic, okay?
Can I see inside it?
The magic won't work if you do that.
Like Santa?
Yes, exactly like Santa.
She gave a box of raisins to Perry Lake, one of the big kids at school who knew everything about everything.
What happens to dead bodies after they die?
He shoved a fistful of raisins into his mouth and chewed.
Depends, he said.
On what? On how many boxes of these you got.
The next day, Millie upended her school bag at his feet. A pile of raisin boxes poured out. He opened one and emptied the contents into his mouth.
They go hard.
Hard?
Yeah. And cold.
Cold?
Yeah.
Like plastic?
He shrugged.
Maybe.
Do they shrink?
Shrink?
Yeah.
He threw a raisin up in the air and caught it in his mouth.
Dead bodies do not shrink.
Millie's smothering a heaped bowl of banana lollies with chocolate topping. When the thought occurs to her, she puts her hand on the mannequin's.
Don't take this the wrong way,
she says, his hand cold and hard underneath hers.
But
she leans into his face. His eyes look back at her like he is only a drawing.
Are you a dead thing?
The third day of waiting. Millie sits in the office in the back of the department store. It looks different in the daylight. There is a desk with pens and paper clips positioned neatly side by side, and an in tray and an out tray that don't have anything in or out of them. Millie picks up a paper clip and a pen, and puts one in the in tray and one in the out tray. The yellow dress she wore last night is folded in the center of the desk. There is a big television screen attached to the side wall. She flicks at the matchbox car wheels on the bottom of her gumboots. She opens her book of dead things, laying it flat on the table and smoothing down the pages. She stares at the picture she drew of her dad's magic box. The dash pulses at her, like it has a heartbeat. She knows about dashes now, that you can carry lots of them around in your pocket. Harry Bird, the picture says. 1968 to 2012.
Loved.
She says the word out loud.
Loved.
By who?
Millie had said to her mum. They were standing hand in hand, looking at her dad's magic box like it was a painting.
You,
her mum replied.
And you?
Her mum cleared her throat.
Of course.
Millie watched her twist her wedding ring around and around her finger. She had started wearing it again that week.
And everyone else?
Yes, Millie.
Why doesn't the sign say that then?
Millie!
She shook Millie's hand loose, kneeled on the ground and put her head in her hands. Millie didn't move.
Mum?
Because nothing's free, Millie, her mum said. Not even this shit.
Her mum didn't look at her as she stood and walked off towards the car.
Come on,
she said. Millie took one last look at her dad's magic box before following. When the ladies from tennis dropped by their house that night, one of them hugged Millie and said,
His body is gone, but his soul is still with us.
Is that what's in the magic box?
Millie asked.
It's in you,
the lady said, placing a flat palm on Millie's chest. Millie looked down at the lady's hand.
How did it get there?
It's always been there.
What?
Proper girls don't say what.
What?
Proper girls say pardon me.
Pardon me?
Good girl.
The lady from tennis stood to hug Millie's mother.
Pardon me?
Millie said again, but the women didn't hear her. The next day, Millie went to the milk bar. While the girl who worked there giggled with a boy who didn't work there, she filled up her school bag with raisins and walked out.
What's a soul?
She said to Perry Lake, after showing him the raisins.
It's like a heart, but it's in your stomach, he replied.
What's it look like?
Like a really big raisin.
He eyed her school bag. She zipped up her bag and held it behind her back.
What happens to it when you die?
Falls out.
It falls out?
Yeah, like a placebo.
What's a placebo?
They fall out of women after they have a baby or whatever.
What do they do with it?
They put it in the freezer and eat it.
Your soul?
No, the placebo. They keep your soul.
Where?
Some other freezer.
Where's that?
The school bell rang in the distance. Kids ran past them, yelling and laughing in packs.
Somewhere, Perry said, rolling his eyes. I don't know. I don't know everything.
Could I have it without knowing?
Perry put out a hand. It was long and thin and bony.
Just give me the raisins, he said.
The door to the office bursts open. Millie feels the draft from the movement of the door, and it sucks at her clothes like a vacuum. Millie sits up straight in the air, snaps her book shut and slides it behind her back. A lady stands in the doorway, mid-conversation with someone out of sight.
What about dinner at mine tonight?
The lady says quietly.
No, Helen. It's a man's voice.
No?
I'm making Mexican. I'm busy.
Tomorrow?
Busy.
You'll just get back to me then.
Helen, I'm busy for the rest of my life.
Okay then, Stan,
she says brightly, louder now. I'll bring over that bruise dispersing cream for you. We can rub that thing right out.
Millie sees the back of the man as he walks off.
You're not touching my face, Helen, he says.
Righto then,
she says to his retreating back.
You just let me know, won't you, Stan?
She turns to face Millie. Helen's small for a grown-up, but wide, as if all her height has gone outward. The buttons cling to her blouse, like people hanging from a cliff. Millie looks down at the lady's shoes. Small, black, clumpy.
Well,
the lady says, as if she can't believe how exciting the word is to say. She plonks herself into the chair on the other side of the desk. Her cheeks are pink and round.
Haven't you got yourself into a pickle?
She picks up a remote from the desk and points it at the wall. The television comes alive. Millie appears on the screen. It's hard to make out, and it's in black and white with no sound, but it's definitely Millie. TV Millie is outside of this office. She walks up to the window, peers through it, pokes her tongue out, grabs the keys out of the door handle, and walks away. Helen presses pause on the remote. Real-life Millie looks at TV Millie. It's so strange to look at herself doing something she's already done and that she can't undo. Real-life Millie looks defiantly at Helen. Helen raises both eyebrows. Real-life Millie raises both eyebrows back. What Millie did last night. Millie knew the way home, but believed her mum was making sure Millie knew how to do what she was told, that she knew how to be good. So, after a talk with the mannequin at dinner, Millie decided to make things easier for her mum to find her. Using paints from the hardware section, she painted "In Here, Mum," as tall as she could on the glass of the automatic doors. Backward, of course, so her mum could read it from the outside. She arranged the Connect Four pieces so they formed a right-turning arrow and placed the stand near the entrance. All the mannequins lining the aisles had their arms positioned so they were pointing in the direction Millie's mum should follow. Some of them held signs.
"Hi, Mum,"
one said. "Keep going," said another. "Stop here for a snack," said the next mannequin, and Millie placed one of her roll-ups in its upturned hand. The Guess Who people were arranged in an arrow. The houses from Monopoly indicated a left turn. The Twister Spinner gestured forward. The nine mannequins closest to the undies each held a letter on a piece of paper to spell "In Here, Mum." The mannequin with the Hawaiian shirt held the final M. She hooked some bras together and strung them from the mannequin's hand across the aisle, tying them to the top of the ginormous women's underwear rack like a finish line. Millie decorated the trail with Christmas lights she found in a bargain bin, and then, letting her red boots poke out just a little bit, lay under the giant undies to wait. But when the shoes came, they weren't gold.
"Are you with that man?" Helen is saying. "The singing one?"
She opens the desk drawer and begins lining up its contents in a neat row on the desk. A Toblerone wrapper.
"He seemed lovely."
An empty juice box.
"But is he a little bit..."
Fly's glass jar.
"A little bit..."
Two hands full of lolly wrappers. She sprinkles them all over the desk, dropping them from high above her head, as if she's showing Millie how rain works.
"Soft. In the head? No?
Oh, of course not. I'm sorry." A roll-up.
"But is he... slow? A bit..."
She leans across the desk and whispers,
"Retarded?"
She clasps a hand over her mouth.
"Oh, of course not. I'm sorry. I can't believe I just said that. I didn't want to remove him from the shop. It's just that..." Stan has a very high standard for this place.
Helen runs her fingers thoroughly over the roll-up. She leans towards the doorway.
He's very particular, she says loudly. She sits back in her chair. Does that man, the singing one, does he have a dungeon or anything?
She disappears under the desk, emerges with a pile of board games and places them on the desk in a teetering pile. Connect Four, Battleship, Twister, Monopoly. She rests an elbow on the top of the pile.
Whips and things? Chains? He doesn't chain anyone up, does he?
We're friends since yesterday, Millie says. He's just an old man, she continues. You can be an old lonely man hanging around girl children and be completely normal. Right?
She ducks under the desk again and comes to stand holding Millie's backpack in one hand and an open bucket of paint in the other. Ta-da! The paint slops over the side and drips onto the floor.
It's society, you know.
Helen pauses, puts the backpack and paint on the table, moves the pile of board games aside and sits on the desk.
Is all this...
She wriggles her index finger at Millie's face.
For him? The makeup?
Millie wipes a hand across her lips. There's a smudge of bright red on the top of her hand, like war paint.
I'm hungry, she says.
Oh, darling, I'm sorry. I had cookies, but...
Stan, she says loudly out the doorway again.
Stan ate them. He'll eat my cookies when it suits him.
She waits, her ear cocked towards the door. Stan appears in the doorway and Helen jumps. Millie sucks in a breath. It's the security guard from last night. He has a black eye. He's on his mobile phone, but he stares at Millie, unblinking, pushing the pads of his fingers into the swelling on his cheekbone.
Well, I'd finished The Cosby Show on DVD and wanted to get something else, didn't I? He says to the phone. Didn't know I was going to get attacked.
He's still staring at Millie.
Helen let me out this morning.
Millie's whole body feels like it's clenching.
Listen, Ma, can you hang on a tick?
He puts his hand over the mouthpiece.
You better get us something to eat, Helen, Stan says, before they come.
Helen jumps off the desk.
Of course!
She says and opens another drawer. She's flushed red in the face.
Mentos? They're surprisingly satiating.
Before who comes?
Millie says.
I'm on a diet, Helen says. The Atkins one? Is it Atkins or Paleo? You get to smell all the food you want. It's fantastic.
She looks sideways at Stan.
Not that I need to.
She rips the packet of Mentos, pops two in her mouth and two on the desk for Millie. Millie picks them up and chews them greedily.
Go on a diet, I mean. I'm not one of those women who worries about these sorts of things. It's more about treating myself like I deserve. It's very empowering.
Stan rolls his eyes.
Helen, he says, just get us something proper, okay? They'll be here soon. They got a ways to travel, so she needs to be fed.
He gives Millie a last look, turns and leaves.
Huh?
Millie hears him say into the phone as he walks away.
No, it was a little kid. I'm not suing her, Ma. Mum, I'm not. Well, they left her here, didn't they? They can't have much.
He's lovely, isn't he, Stan?
She looks out the door and spits the Mentos into a tissue.
Who's coming?
Millie says. She is sick in the stomach.
Mum will be here, she adds. She's just lost.
Oh, darling,
Helen says, throwing the tissue into the rubbish bin by her feet and wiping her hands on her trousers.
I'm sure she is.
My dad died, but my mum will be here.
Oh, darling.
She walks around to Millie's side of the desk and kneels on the ground in front of her. She grabs one of Millie's hands and holds it with both of hers.
How did he pass? Oh, don't answer that.
Helen talks like she is surprised by the words that come out of her own mouth, as if someone else is saying them.
Don't, if you don't want. But if you want, how was it that he passed? Was he into gambling? A little bit? Did he get mixed up in something?
Mixed up?
Drugs, Helen whispers.
They gave him drugs at the hospital.
Was it a mental hospital?
What's that?
Forget I said anything.
He had cancer.
Oh, sweetheart. I had cancer once. Well, I thought I did. Oh, terrible time. Terrible. Turns out it was just a very big boil.
My mum will be here.
Right on my neck. Right here. Terrible time. What? Oh, of course, sweetheart. Of course she will.
A phone rings in Helen's pocket. Helen jumps to her feet and answers it.
Yes, yes, she's right here, of course. Yes, yes.
She hangs up.
Oh, darling, they're coming for you.
Who?
Child Services. They're so fantastic with abandoned children.
Abandoned?
They'll give you another mum and dad for a little while until they find yours.
Through the doorway, Helen watches Stan laugh with a young female staff member.
But Mum said to wait here.
I know, darling, I know, but...
She sighs and walks to the door, putting her hand on the doorframe and watching Stan.
Some people don't always say what they mean.
Millie grips her book of dead things tightly behind her back. Helen whips around to face Millie. Her body wobbles under her shirt. The button people claw desperately at the cliff edge.
Oh, don't worry, darling. They'll love you. You're adorable. Now, darling, just wait right here. Yes. Promise? Yes.
She pauses and they stare at each other.
I'll bring back juice and cookies. Yes?
Without waiting for an answer, she walks out the door. Millie watches Helen walk away and out of sight. She wants to throw up. A kid walks by the open office door with his mum and screams,
But I want the blue one!
Millie wants to scream in his face,
But I want my mum!
Millie rips off the matchbox cars from the bottom of her gumboots and climbs down from the chair. She grabs her bag and puts the toy cars inside. She takes a quick look out the door. No Helen, no Stan. She takes a deep breath and runs as fast as she can in the direction of the cafe. Her bag slides up and down her back, down the aisle with the brooms and cloths and mops in bright colours, past the photo lab, people flicking through photos on bright screens, past the CDs and phones and electrical gadgets. Millie hides behind a cardboard cutout of a famous singer when she sees Stan coming. He flicks through the DVDs and mumbles to himself.
Got it, don't want it, got it, he says.
His phone rings.
Yeah, I'll be there.
He walks right past her and doesn't see her. At the cafe, Carl is in his usual spot. Millie hides behind her usual pot plant. She spies Helen at the counter.
Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom.
Just a small bit of cake, please,
Helen's saying to the girl behind the counter.
The carrot cake, please?
Yes, just two pieces, please.
Yes, please, that one. Great, thank you. Just the three pieces. That'll be fine.
Carl,
Millie whispers. Carl sits up and turns towards the pot plant. He says, Yes?
It's Millie.
She pokes her head around the fern leaves.
Just Millie? Where have you been?
From the cover of the pot plant, Millie gives him a rundown of the events since she last saw him.
First the mannequin saved my life, then I stole a key, then a security guard was locked in, then we had dinner, Rambo was there, and the hobby horse, and the guess who people, and the mannequin, I'll introduce you later, and then I asked the mannequin if he was a dead thing, and then I tried to help Mum, and then Helen offered me juice and cookies, but I didn't get either, and then my new Mum and Dad were coming, and then I escaped, and then I found you. Are you going to eat that?
Carl hands her his muffin. That's all?
That's all,
she says, her mouth full.
Escaped from who?
Her!
Millie points and ducks as Helen, no more than 20 metres away from them, talks to a customer.
They're not for me,
Helen says. I'm on a diet, the North Beach one. Kate Moss uses it. You can hold all the food you like. Carl looks the other way as Helen walks past them and back toward the office. An escape, you say? He stands. Okay.
Okay?
Millie says.
We're getting you out of here, right now, he says loudly.
The girl looks up at him from behind the coffee machine.
Shh,
Millie whispers. Carl sits.
Yes, sorry about that. He waves at the girl.
But we should go.
Yes, he says, and stands again. They make their way to the giant undies, sticking to the aisles in between the main ones. The mannequin in the Hawaiian shirt looks down at her. Millie can't look away.
Grab him,
Millie says.
What?
Proper men say pardon me.
Pardon me?
We're taking him.
Him?
Yes!
Why?
He saved my life.
Carl looks at Millie, then at the mannequin, then back at Millie.
I will do that, he says too loudly again. Any friend of yours is a friend of mine.
Shh!
Millie says. Oh, yes, right. Carl picks up the mannequin and holds him so they're dancing cheek to cheek.
Ready?
Millie says. Ready, Carl answers. They snake their way past the appliances, the cookware, the colouring books, the towels. A woman tries to spray perfume on Carl as he walks by. He giggles. The entrance is metres in front of them. It shines blindingly in the middle of everything. They're running and causing a scene, but no one seems to notice, and they're going to make it.
We're invisible,
says Millie.
Yes,
says Carl. They look at each other and smile. They are actually going to make it. But then Millie sees the Guess Who people looking up at them, and it's too late to say anything. And Carl's foot catches on their faces, and he falls headfirst into the bargain bin full of Christmas lights in the middle of the aisle. Millie falls at the same time, hitting her head on the side of the bin. Carl drops the mannequin on top of her, and a leg comes loose and skids across the floor. Then the three words she doesn't want to hear.
There she is!
Helen and Stan and a man and a woman wearing fancy, uncomfortable clothes coming toward them. Her new mum. Her new dad.
Come on, Carl!
Millie says, standing, rubbing her head and pulling at his arm. But he's managed to get himself all twisted up in the Christmas lights, and his thrashing about is only making matters worse.
Grab him, Stan!
Says Helen, running toward them behind the security guard.
I think he's... I mean, I don't want to jump to any conclusions, but everybody, based on what I've seen, he's probably, most definitely, I think.
Carl's arms and legs are still flailing all over the place when Stan catches up with them. He helps Carl out of the bin and holds on to his arm.
Okay, you dirty old bastard, Stan says. Show's over.
Oh, Stan,
Helen says, running up to them breathless.
You did it.
She puts a hand on his upper arm and her eyes widen.
You're so strong.
Carl doesn't look at Millie but says,
Go, Millie, go! I'll find you!
Out at the side of his mouth. And the Guess Who people look at her like they expect her to do something. So Millie grabs the mannequin's leg and she does something. She weaves through the forest of people, around and under and through.
Go, Millie, go!
She sings as she runs as fast as she can out the door and through the parking lot. As she's running, she looks back, and it's still there, painted in big letters that slide over each other as the doors open and close. In here, Mum. Millie walks up the pathway to her house, places the mannequin's leg on the step, and tries to open the door. It's locked. She grabs the spare key from under the mat, unlocks the door, checks the street for the police car that's been looking for her, and then walks in. It's cold and dark. She's tired from running all the way from the department store. From the doorway, she says, "Mom!" Millie walks into the kitchen. "Mom!" The word echoes off the walls. Dishes are piled high in the sink, and there's something in the rubbish that stinks. She walks into the lounge room.
"Mom?"
The couch is huge in its emptiness, and the television is a big black hole in the center of their lounge room. Why has she never noticed how big and black it is? How it looks like you could press a button and it would suck up your whole house. Her dad's beer cozy is on the coffee table. Millie holds it up to the light streaming through the window. Dust particles dance around it in the sunlight. She rubs the material with her fingertips. It's black, with a yellow map of Australia on one side and a very big boobed woman in a bikini on the other. Millie slides onto her forearm and rubs it against her cheek. She walks into her mum and dad's room. Her mum's side of the bed is all rumpled up. She lies under the covers for a bit, pulling them over her head. It's cold and dark in there too. She reaches her hand across to her dad's side, then peels back the covers, stands, and presses the palm of her hand on the wardrobe door, like she's trying to make a handprint on it. She closes her eyes and slides the door across. When she opens her eyes, there is nothing there but wire coat hangers, like the shoulders of skeletons. She sits on the bed and drags her fingers through the air, and it feels like nothing, and she wants to say,
"Sorry, Mum. I am so sorry, Mum. I am sorry for doing the things I did."
A fact about the world Millie knows for sure. Sorry is sometimes the only thing left to say.
"What should you say when someone dies?"
she whispered to her dad as her mum watched Deal or No Deal. The sister of a girl at school had died, and her teacher had told Millie to make a card. "Mill's baby," her dad whispered back. He hoisted her up onto his lap. "No one is going to die." She furrowed her brow.
"Everyone's going to die."
"Well?" he said and stopped. He put his hands under her armpits and twisted her around to face him. "Well, yes, but no one you know."
"Everyone I know."
"But not any time soon."
"How do you know?"
"I just know." "What on earth are you two talking about?" her mum said as the ads blared out of the television.
"Mum,"
Millie said, looking at the back of her mum's head.
"What do you say to your friends when people they love die?"
Her mum turned around and flashed her dad a look. She grabbed Millie by both hands and leaned into her face.
"You don't need to know any of this stuff, Millie," she said. "You're just a child, a little girl."
"You should be, I don't know, playing dollies, offices, shops." Millie shrugged. Her mum sat back in her chair and eyed her. "Who was it?"
"Beck's sister, from school."
Deal or No Deal came back on the telly. "Send them a card," her mum said, turning back toward the television. "Say something nice on it."
"Like what?"
"Like, Deal, are you kidding me? Take the money!" Millie's dad put his hand on Millie's head. It felt so gigantic on there. "Say, I'm sorry for your loss."
"It's not my fault."
"Of course not." He put his arms around her and pushed her head into his chest. "Just be kind," he said. "That's all." Later, when Millie's dad was dead, her mum sat in front of the telly, all day, every day, and Millie put her hand on her mum's arm and said,
I'm sorry for your loss.
And her mum hugged her, so tight Millie could hardly breathe, and said,
I'm sorry for your loss too, Millie.
And now, as she looks out the window from her mum and dad's bedroom, scanning the street for the police car, she locks eyes with the old lady across the road. She, too, is looking out the window from her house. She, too, Millie can tell, has lost someone. Millie doesn't know how she can tell, but she just can.
I'm sorry for your loss,
Millie mouths at her, slowly and deliberately, her forehead on the glass of the window. The old lady stares at her, and then pulls the curtains shut.
Agatha Panther. Agatha Panther had tried to avoid her husband's naked body as much as possible throughout their marriage. It was too grasshoppery, all bent over and thin. His bones appeared surprised to be there, jutting out of his skin as though they were trying to find the exit. On their wedding night, when he unzipped her dress in that damp way that would soon become unbearably familiar, she caught sight of his penis, glinting in the moonlight like an unsheathed sword. She finally understood why he always walked as if he were being pushed from behind. It seemed abnormally large for his body. During the sex, he unfurled his body and presented himself to her like a magic trick. She looked at him with blurred eyes, trying to melt his body into the walls. He assumed they were her sex eyes, the eyes you practice in the mirror from the moment you guess that something like sex exists. When the deed was done, and he scampered to the bathroom, Agatha pulled the blanket up under her chin and imagined his penis swaying from one leg to the other as he walked, like an orangutan swinging through the jungle. As she lay there, waiting for his return, it was not surprise, shock, or even rage that she felt. It was disappointment. Disappointment that having a man flounder about on top of her like a piece of cooked spinach was the best humankind could come up with. She remembered learning that all men had these monstrosities dangling between their legs. She couldn't look at a man for a number of months afterward. Just the knowledge that there were so many hidden penises around unnerved her. She didn't know how other women could live in a world like this. She felt surrounded, trapped. Men walked past her in the street and said, "Hello," with such smugness, and all Agatha could do was look at the ground and think, "He has a penis, he has a penis, he has a penis." Later, though, as she watched her husband's penis sadden and age, as all creatures do eventually, she was able to look men in the eye as they walked past her in the street. "Hello," she would answer back, her eyes clear, her lips calm. But she would think, "I pity you and your dying penis." Ron's saddening penis was Agatha's first clue that her husband was aging. The second came when she saw the hair in his ears waving in the wind like the hands of drowning men. She watched on helplessly as hair began to disappear from one place on his body and reappear in others. Third was a stroke that made him lose feeling in his left leg. He had to hold on to his thigh and pull it alongside him when he walked. Hop, drag, hop, drag, hop, drag. Fourth was the plastic bedpan he took to keeping on his bedside table at night time. Consequently, Agatha's mornings began with a soft splash of her husband's urine against the sides of it as he dragged himself to the toilet. Hop, splash, drag, splash. Hop, splash, drag, splash. One morning, she realized the orange juice made the same noise as she carried it to the breakfast table. She never bought it again. Fifth was the development of a fat deposit that reached from his chin to the bottom of his neck like a pelican gullet. Every word he uttered was punctuated by this soundless tremble of flesh, crescendoing out from his face the louder he spoke. It wobbled at her day and night, as permanent a fixture in her life as the sun, and, like the sun, she could only just bear to look at it. It was around this point that she stopped talking to her husband. She grunted, sighed, nodded, pointed, elbowed, but never spoke. It wasn't malicious. She just had nothing left to say. They had covered their likes, dislikes, differences, similarities, height, weight, shoe size. They had spent 45 years having arguments, sharing opinions, discussing just how one might go about winning the Price is Right. She could now, with startling accuracy, predict what he would say, think, do, wear, and eat. What she did have left to say, like, "Get it yourself," was easily achieved by gesture. So they ate together, slept together, sat together, breathed together, but had never been further apart. When her husband died, neighbors suddenly dropped by unannounced, appearing on her doorstep from behind huge, hulking casseroles full of dead animals and pity. Their children carried slabs of coconut slice and looked put out. They all set up camp in her kitchen, as though they were running a political campaign. They materialized in her hallway, her bedroom, and her bathroom, as if they could walk through walls, cocking their head to one side and clawing at her. They talked with their faces only centimeters away from hers. "I understand," they all said, "because Susie, Fido, Henry died last year, last week, 10 years ago, because she, it, he had lung cancer, was hit by a car, wasn't really dead, but was dead to her because he was living with a 26-year-old on the Gold Coast." "Why are there 19 bunches of flowers in my sunroom?" she asked on one of her frequent wanderings from room to room. No one answered. The flowers were elaborate explosions of things, like bouquets of fireworks frozen in time. Philip Stone from Number 6 gave her a cup of tea she didn't want and placed a hand on her shoulder. He had never touched her before. "Let it out, Agatha," he said. The heat of his palm made her skin prickle unpleasantly beneath the fabric of her blouse. "I don't have a cat, if that's what you're getting at," she replied, stepping out of his reach. "You're in denial," said Kim Lim from Number 32, their noses almost touched. "Don't be afraid to express your sadness," she added. Agatha smelled coconut slice on her breath. She caught Frances Pollop from Number 12 in her wardrobe, wielding a tape gun in the air like a chainsaw. Ron's clothes were in boxes all over the floor. Agatha and Frances looked at each other. The tape gun wobbled a little above Frances's head. After a good minute, Agatha turned and walked out, closing the bedroom door behind her. And then, just as suddenly, they all vanished. They left behind crockpots, foreign smells, and the loudness of silence. Through the window, Agatha watched them walk out of her gate and down the road to their houses. The lights in their windows were like pupils, their letterboxes like periscopes. Even the flowers in their front yards seemed to be gathered around in a circle, whispering to one another. She left the lights off. The boxes of her husband's clothes had been pushed against the wall in the hallway. Even in the darkness, she could see "Salvos" written on each one in black marker. The letters had been traced and retraced over and over. Sticky tape was wrapped ferociously around the center of each box. The phone rang in the kitchen. Her answering machine clicked on. "You've reached Agatha Panther," it said in someone else's voice. "Please leave a message." The absence of his name felt like vertigo. "Agatha?" another voice said. "Are you there?" She didn't know the answer to that. Agatha stood in her bedroom and stared at her husband's slippers. It was what she did now. Just walked around and stood in rooms. She felt it then, something trying to clamber its way out of her throat. Agatha held on to the bedpost and swallowed over and over again until it went away.
"It's all this talk," she said to her husband's slippers. "They're talking me into it."
She sat on the bed and cupped her knees with her hands.
"How do you get old without letting sadness become everything?"
Her mother had been young once, with her easy limbs and pretty fingers. But then she had saddened and shrunk. The ends of her sentences began to tremble, and she seemed to be always holding her breath. Agatha's relatives had called this grief. They didn't say the word out loud, but mouthed it as if it were blasphemy. Agatha, a fully grown and married woman at this point, opinions of her own beginning to gather steam in her head, thought the word vague, cartoonish. Most of all, she thought her mother's state was something you could avoid, like sidestepping a puddle on the street. At the time, Agatha hadn't realized she was looking into the future, that her mother was her, that soon Agatha would be her. Wasn't evolution about being better than your mother? Agatha did not feel better than her mother. She could see her mother in her now, in her spotted hands, in the death lines that marked her face, in the varicose veins running up her legs like tree roots. She felt the sickening inevitability of the whole thing. Like becoming her mother was the point of it all. So Agatha stood in the kitchen and opened the fridge. Light flooded the room. She peered into it, her eyes adjusting. Arms of meatloaf and finger sandwiches and pink cupcakes topped with nippled cherries lined the shelves. One by one, she removed all the casseroles. She whisked them out of her house and upturned them on the footpath. Chicken stock and carrot and gravy and onion and hunks of beef splashed satisfyingly on her shins. She gathered a load of lamingtons in her arms and launched them from the doorway. They landed in her rose bushes, on the windshields of parked cars, at the foot of nearby letterboxes. She hurled a three-tiered sponge cake over her head like a soccer throw-in. It separated in the air, and red jam splattered thick on her driveway. She lined the sandwiches up along the top of her small brick fence. With both arms held out, she walked the length of it, feeling the sandwiches squish underneath her feet. Slices of cucumber squirted out the sides. She balanced two pink frosted cupcakes on top of her letterbox. She wrapped both hands around a hunk of meatloaf, drew it back behind her head, and followed through. The meatloaf fell apart in her hands. The cupcakes tumbled onto the footpath. A cherry landed next to her foot, and she kicked it. She washed the Tupperware, the casserole dishes, and the old ice cream buckets, the water in the sink rising high up the sides as she thrashed her hands about. She dried them all with violent flourishes, and then she stacked them, one on top of the other, in her driveway. Like a totem pole from some forgotten ancient culture. There was a sadness to the soft sway of it that Agatha tried to ignore. She wrote a cardboard sign to place beside it.
"Thank you for your kindness," it read in big dark letters.
She traced and retraced the letters.
"But I do not require it,"
she added in smaller letters.
"Also, I don't care for coconut."
She stood on her doorstep and blinked through the sweat on her eyelids. She ate a potato bake straight from the Pyrex dish with her fingers and surveyed what she had done. Was it art or was it war? She had never understood either, but as she watched the river of food in the gutter flow down the street, she thought perhaps it might be both. The lights from the homes around her flicked on and off like warning signals. She pushed a fistful of potato and cheese into her mouth. She sensed the street tensing.
"I'm expressing my sadness, Kim Lim," she yelled into the night, flecks of potato bake flying. She stepped inside, slammed the front door behind her, and locked it.
She locked the back door. She locked the windows. She closed all the curtains.
"I'm turning the television on now," she yelled.
And she did, shadows skittering all over the walls. She turned the volume up as high as it could go. White noise filled the room. She dragged a chair to the front window and sat down, leaning forward. She pulled back the curtain so she could see out into the street.
"Ksh,"
said the television in the background. The sun was coming up.
"I can't wait to see their faces," she yelled.
Yelling seemed to help. 7 years have passed, and Agatha has not left her house since that night. Not to water the garden, or catch a bus, or sweep the driveway. She has not opened her front door, or her curtains. She has not listened to the radio, or read the newspapers. She has not turned the television off, and the ksh sound is the only truth of which Agatha is sure. 7 years of unopened mail floods her hallway. She wades through the letters when walking from her bedroom to the lounge room.
"Just because you know my name," she yells at them, "doesn't mean I owe you anything."
They seem to snap at her heels. Every Monday, a woman from the supermarket leaves a box of food under her window. A man from the post office collects her bill money from the doorstep and feeds mail through the slot in her door every second Tuesday. She pays them in envelopes marked,
"Here, take it,"
that she slides under the front door. The grass on the front lawn lies flat and brown amid the dust. The weeds grow tall. Ivy covers the house. Agatha has opened the front window and put her hand through to cut a hole out of the ivy with her sewing scissors. She does not know what is going on in the world, but she knows what is going on in her street. She has acquired that blob body, synonymous with old women, where it becomes difficult to tell where anything begins or ends. Her chin sprouts long, meandering hairs. She always plucks them, but they always return, as if they are part of God's plan. She has taken to wearing brown-tinted sunglasses, from the moment she wakes until the moment she goes to sleep. For Agatha, the brown shield around her eyes acts like cornflour, thickening and slowing the world around her. A day in the life of Agatha Panther. 6 a.m. Wakes without an alarm. Doesn't open her eyes until she's wearing her brown glasses. Notes the time on the clock on the wall in front of her. Nods approvingly. Walks to the bathroom to the beat of the ticking clock. Is careful not to trip over her husband's slippers, which have not been moved since the last time he wore them. 6:05 to 6:45. Sits in the chair of disbelief and measures cheek elasticity, distance from nipples to waist, foreign hair growth, wrinkle count, projected wrinkle trajectory, and arm wobblage. Notes the data in an exercise book titled Age. Narrates the entire event while looking at herself in the mirror.
"I'm measuring arm wobblage now," she yells at herself, while she bats a hand at the underside of her upper arm. "It's up from yesterday," she yells after checking the data. "It's always up from yesterday."
6:46. Allows herself one deep, dark sigh. 6:47. Showers.
"I'm washing myself now," she yells.
She never yells anything too specific in the shower. 7:06. Dresses in one of her four brown skirt suits.
"Stockings,"
she yells as she pulls them over her belly button.
"Skirt. Blouse. Shoes.